you think if you would just love them enough that they'll change, or you can maybe heal that part of them and they'll stop hurting you, but you're actually just an enabler.
Welcome to The One You Feed. Throughout time, great thinkers have recognized the importance of the thoughts we have. Quotes like garbage in, garbage out, or you are what you think ring true. And yet, for many of us, our thoughts don't strengthen or empower us. We tend toward negativity, self-pity, jealousy, or fear. We see what we don't have instead of what we do. We think things that hold us back and dampen our spirit. But it's not just about thinking. Our actions matter. It takes conscious, consistent, and creative effort to make a life worth living. This podcast is about how other people keep themselves moving in the right direction, how they feed their good wolf.
When you buy Kroger brand products, you feel like you're winning. That's because they offer proven quality at lower than low prices. In fact, we guarantee that you and your family will love how Kroger brand products taste, or you get your money back. So next time you're shopping for the family, look for delicious Kroger brand products, because they'll make you all feel like you're winning. Shop now, in-store, or online. Kroger, fresh for everyone.
Thanks for joining us. Our guest on this episode is Rachel Krantz, one of three founding editors of Bustle, and she's the recipient of the Peabody Award, the Robert F. Kennedy Center for Justice and Human Rights International Radio Award, the Investigative Reporters and Editors Radio Award, and the Edward R. Murrow Award for her work as an investigative reporter with Wire Media. Rachel is also the host of Help Existing, a new interview podcast offering help with different aspects of existence, and the author of the book discussed on this episode, Open, an Uncensored Memoir of Love, Liberation, and Non-Monogamy.
Hi, Rachel. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, I'm excited to have you on. We're going to be discussing your book called Open, an Uncensored Memoir of Love, Liberation, and Non-Monogamy. But before we do that, let's start like we always do with the parable. In the parable, there's a grandparent who's talking with a grandchild, and they say, in life, there are two wolves inside of us that are always at battle. One is a good wolf, which represents things like kindness and bravery and love. And the other is a bad wolf, which represents things like greed and hatred and fear. And the grandchild stops and thinks about it for a second and says, well, which one wins? And the grandparent says, the one you feed. So I'd like to start off by asking you what that parable means to you in your life and in the work that you do.
Well, you know, it makes me think actually of not the two wolves, but our two closest genetic relatives, chimpanzees and bonobos, which are actually very representative of the same parable. So chimpanzees, more people know about, they're the less endangered species. They're actually, despite being adorable, patriarchal, violent, can wage warfare, there's sexual assault, all these things. Then there's our other closest genetic relative, even a slight percentage more closely related to us, bonobos, much less studied and well-known, partially because they're very endangered, but also because they're a matriarchal species. All the females are bisexual. They're very nonviolent. They use sex to diffuse conflict. And so you think about that, and those sides are so obviously in tension or present in all humans, right? The desire for domination and warfare, maybe the bad wolf, the worst of us, and then also the side of us that are lovers and want to be peaceful and perhaps more fluid and emotional in loving ways. And so I guess I think with that parable that both sides are within us and that it's also very fluid. I don't tend to like dualistic thinking because I've seen, you know, for example, with emotions like jealousy that are represented in the book, very much the bad wolf, that it's true. The more you feed it, the more it grows. I do think what you practice grows stronger, good or bad. At the same time, I saw how disavowing that bad wolf, aka jealousy or shame or whatever else, also fed it. So the more I was angry at the bad wolf of, you shouldn't be feeling this, or why are you feeling this, that also made it stronger. So I think one lesson to me is that we kind of have to love and accept the bad wolf too, rather than disavowing it or trying to reject it completely. Feed the good, but recognize that it's all fluid and part of us.
Yeah. I think that is such an interesting dynamic to think about, which is, how do we deal with, you know, quote unquote, negative thoughts and emotions, right? It's pretty easy to think about feeding the good. So, okay, you write a lot about this, nurturing the good, right? Noticing the good things in your life and paying more attention to them, which is definitely, you know, the cultivation side. And then there comes the other side. And I like the parable sort of because it really doesn't mention what we should do with the bad wolf. It doesn't say you have to starve him, because I think that's a really nuanced and important point. And I think is becoming more and more clear. And I hear more and more people answer the parable that way these days, saying, well, hang on, let's not put the bad wolf in a cage, or let's give him some attention. I want to start off with a line that you wrote recently. Maybe it was on Twitter. I don't know where it originated, but you wrote, when you're a woman writing about sex and early readers start calling you brave, you know you're about to be in for some shit. I assume that you have gotten some.
Yeah, I have. I've been very heartened that the love and kindness has so far outweighed the trolling or negativity. I was not expecting that, to be honest. Like, I think perhaps was more cynical of, I'm going to just get harassed really badly all the time. And I think the fact that that hasn't been the case, that it's been more minimal, or that I've so far been able to control it by having certain limits in place, like no contact form on my website, unfortunately, is for that reason. Mm-hmm. But that said, my DMs on social media are open, and I find by and large, it's just people reaching out with kindness and really feeling less alone, either in my talking about themes of emotional abuse and gaslighting or non-monogamy and more flawed depictions of what can go wrong in those relationships, rather than only having a perfect representation all the time. People have just been appreciative. So that's been really heartening to see that there's less shit than I thought. But that said, I think there's still, there's a lot of trolling and negativity. I think what's been more hurtful to me has to see from certain media establishments comments like, oh, we can't cover it because we just had a polyamory book 3 months ago. And so there's so obviously like a quota for how much is this representation allowed. Whereas I hope now we're at a point in the culture where they wouldn't say to me as a queer woman or Jewish woman, oh, we just had a Jewish queer woman 3 months ago. We can't have another. But it's clear that with any representation of non-monogamy, no matter how much the book is really about so many other things, that there's sort of still the idea of this is a ghettoized, limited topic that, you know, we can only cover once or twice a year.
Yep. And I think what you're saying rings true in my experience, and I am not a female who writes openly about sexual topics, so I'm going to get very different things. But the vast, vast, vast majority of feedback that I've ever gotten has been positive. And I think life is like that a lot, in that the good and the bad are there. You're going to have the trolls, and you're going to have a lot of people responding kindly. And back to sort of what we talked about, you kind of have to think about, okay, which of these things do I want to give more attention to? Which of these things do I want to allow to occupy my headspace? Because they're both true and real that they're there. But we sort of get to determine to some degree what we do with the limited real estate sort of in our brain.
Definitely. And one thing that's been important to me is to keep the virtuous cycle going. So when someone reaches out to me with kindness, I always message them back. I'll usually like leave them a voice message if it's on Instagram and thank them and let them know how much that really keeps me going. To hear things like that, that makes me feel like it wasn't just sent out into the void and that all that matters are sales or something like that. But to really hear about how it's impacting individuals, it matters so much. And so I try to reflect back to them how much that kindness really matters, and that I think it's a special kind of person who not only reads a book and is impacted by it, but then is brave enough to reach out to an author they care about. And so to kind of reflect back their goodness, I think is important to then keeping the cycle going of them perhaps reaching out to an author of the next book they read that touches them, or to just see where they can perform more random acts of kindness is important. Yeah, I think it's a great tip for people who don't know. Like, authors are very accessible and they often hear from people less than you'd think. And so it's a really kind thing not to only take the second to give a star rating or a one-line review, even on Goodreads or Amazon, can actually make a huge difference, unfortunately, in how the algorithms work.
Yep.
But also to just send that quick message on social media or through their website, it can really mean a lot to people. Just with all my author friends, hearing from them too, like, that's what makes you know it's worthwhile.
Yep. As a podcaster, same thing. So listeners, I expect lots of emails of support, and I'm kidding, but sort of. But I do love them because you do. I see the numbers of people who are listening. But the best part for me of this has been hearing from people and getting to know them and the programs we've done and the community that we build. That's been what's really special. And I think, like you said, a lot of people assume, oh, they wouldn't want to hear that. They probably get a ton of it. And, you know, until you get to be huge, it's always lovely to hear. Anyway, onward. So let's talk a little bit about non-monogamy / polyamory. Are they the same thing? Just one's describing what it is and the other's describing what it isn't?
Sort of, but a non-monogamy is a larger umbrella. So it's okay. Anything that's not monogamy. So people like swingers or a couple that only has a don't ask, don't tell policy, or it can only be anonymous sex, that would all fall under non-monogamy, as would polyamory. But polyamorists make the distinction that it's kind of in the word, right? More than one love. So that tends to be an emphasis on multiple relationships, multiple emotional attachments, potentially. Whereas you could have other people practicing something that's non-monogamy where they try to compartmentalize, keep emotions out of it, or there's only one relationship to their non-monogamy.
Got it. Okay, that's a very helpful distinction. So the book really talks about, I'm going to summarize it very quickly. I'm going to put your life's work in a sentence. Basically, the book sort of talks a little bit about you, your earlier life, and then you getting in a relationship with someone who polyamorous, wants you to be polyamorous, and you want to give it a try for a lot of different reasons. You know, one is to please him, but also a lot of it is because you think that there's a lot in it for you also. And the book really depicts that relationship, broadly speaking. And that relationship certainly has the polyamory aspects of it, but it also talks about the aspects of that relationship that we might call gaslighting, or I don't know if you would use the word abuse. Maybe that's harder than you would go with the word, but the dynamics in that relationship. And so it's not just the polyamory part of this that makes this whole thing challenging for you. It's also the dynamics of the relationship itself. And so I kind of wanted to, as you do in the book, break those apart a little bit and, you know, start off by talking a little bit about the polyamory part and then maybe move into some more of the other pieces. Talk to me a little bit about what it was from your perspective that made you want to try this type of relationship.
Yeah, well, I was 27 when I met Adam. He was older and more experienced, and I felt the pressure that many people socialized as women feel to find the one before it was too late. Even at 27, I felt that pressure that, oh, this serial monogamy pattern I have of falling in love, growing gradually bored and restless, not feeling my future narrowing, not wanting to only be kissing or one person or never have a first date again for the rest of my life, and to sort of know how that part of my story ended was just so claustrophobic and unappealing to me, because love was my favorite thing to write about, to explore. I loved falling in love, but I also felt like, oh God, I better grow out of this. I hope I grow out of this once I meet the magic one, even though a part of me didn't really believe that was a thing. I guess I was hoping it was, and that it would kind of put my restlessness to bed. And so when I met Adam, and he was saying that he was also looking in some ways for that one, someone to share his life with, a serious life partner. And he was so many of the traits that I found compelling, you know, very, very smart, from a great family, was an adult in a way I hadn't really experienced dating a real grown man, quote unquote, before. I could imagine that future with him, but a future with him, as he pitched it, also meant I wouldn't have to give up that possibility of future adventure. And so, you know, I think I write in the book, he was offering me the chance to eat the cake and have the pie too, right? And so I was like, all right, I guess I better try this. I was familiar with the concept of non-monogamy. And even though it scared me, I was also intrigued and thought perhaps this will work better for me because what I've been doing before is not working.
Right. Right. I can totally relate with that. As I've grown older, my needs and desires have shifted very much. And that isn't something that particularly interests me now. But I think it at 29, for example, very much so. I totally understand that feeling of like, well, I really want a partner that I settle down with. And holy crap, that's it. That's the end of the game, right? That felt really constricting and really hard to imagine. And the idea of having both sounds really wonderful. And Adam pitched it to you in a way that said, like, hey, we can start this with only you having multiple loves, to use the polyamory term, and I won't for now. Mm-hmm. So he gave you sort of an easy way in.
Yes. And that was one of his ways of demonstrating he was serious about me, that this was a long-term commitment or investment. But it was very much understood that that offer would expire and that it was up to me when to lift it.
Yeah.
But it was implicit. But yeah, he also revealed that his kink was seeing me with other men, which had never even occurred to me as a thing that people were into. Like I'd, you know, heard of the other way around, but not that. And so I was like, well, great. So yeah, for the first year, we pretty much just explored things together, which is actually how a lot of people who practice non-monogamy do it, is as a couple. And then when I met someone and started dating them individually, that's when I felt like, I think we need to open this up on your end too. This feels unfair because it's now something that I'm not sharing with you all the time. And that's when my battles with jealousy began, which is an emotion that's very deeply explored and researched in the book.
Yep. And we'll get to that here very shortly. So there's the appeal of, okay, I don't want to only, you know, have one love in life. I want the ability to have, as you said, more adventures, more different things. But there's also an element that this is a preferable way to be because it is more generous. You said being open also seemed like the more generous way to be. It felt like an ultimate act of love to sacrifice your ego in the interest of a partner's bodily autonomy. And I wanted to give that loving generosity back. So there's also something embedded in it that says, hey, this is a better model. It's one based on deep love and commitment for each other and trust, but also generosity and non-possessiveness and non-attachment. So there's, in addition to the cake part and the icing part of it, right? There's also the sense that this may be a more evolved way. Maybe that's not the term you would use, but
it might have been then.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's something that Adam certainly felt and that many polyamorous people have kind of made an argument for, this idea that it is more evolved or loving in certain ways, that it just seemed more generous and less controlling. I think that part of what you see throughout the book is how, no, what matters more is the dynamic. And really, if someone's controlling, they can use non-monogamy to control you or they can use monogamy to control you. It's really less that any relationship model is inherently more enlightened and more about the power dynamics that exist between individuals and how do they relate? Do they exploit those structures, or do they use them as ways to foster security and freedom? So I think that's totally possible for non-monogamy. That's totally possible for monogamy too. But yeah, I think like a lot of people, I had an interest in Buddhism since my early 20s and some knowledge, had gone on some retreats and done some reading, but nowhere near what I have now in terms of really going much deeper and actually studying these concepts and having a monk who's a teacher to me and who I can really untangle these themes with. And so I think that I didn't have a full understanding of what non-attachment actually means. And so I kind of took Adam's word for it as someone who had read more Thich Nhat Hanh and other thinkers of like, okay, this is the more loving, evolved, perhaps enlightened way to be. But actually that ended up being in some ways a tool for their manipulation, which is not totally unusual. We see in any spiritual community, there can be instances of people using it as a means of control or to get sex or to tell people that their reality is unevolved or their emotional reactions are incorrect and that if they can just rise above, they would see it their way, right? So I wanted to show how that kind of spirituality can sometimes be construed, because I think it's actually a very common thing, not just with non-monogamy, but in general.
That's right. And not only is it something that other people use for power and control, it's something we tend to impose on ourselves very much. And you certainly talk about this, how over time, what Adam's views were on things became the views that you thought you should have, not just to make him happy, but that were actually the correct views.
Yes.
And I think that's sort of what I'm describing with the spiritual stuff that you're talking about, is these ideas of non-attachment, we can give them back on ourselves. You know, shouldn't I be better than this? Shouldn't I know better than this? Shouldn't I be more evolved? Shouldn't I be non-attached? All this stuff, which causes us to really suffer.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, that's the thing with gaslighting, which I know we can get into more later, but that what's so insidious about is that like the person takes over your thoughts. So it's incremental, right? It's not something that happens overnight or just with one instance of an argument where there's gaslighting. This is over a period of years where eventually it got to the point that what his opinions and desires were stronger than my own intuition or even the voice inside my head. So if I felt uncomfortable with something, I would immediately hear him in my head arguing why that was incorrect, why that was unloving or unevolved. And so, yeah, you take on their worldview and arguments, and it's a sort of mind control that's made all the more confusing by the fact that the person doing it doesn't always mean to consciously be doing that to you, but it's part of the dynamic that you have gets to a very unhealthy place. But I think also once I got on the other side of that and talked with monk Tashi Nima, who features in the book and who is my teacher, I mentioned that he said, you know, non-attachment is not indifference. It doesn't mean it doesn't matter to you whether you eat poison or healthy food. And it has a lot of near enemies like dissociation. And, you know, he helped me make the distinction of, yes, when an emotion is yours, it is your responsibility, you know, but the distinction is someone else should never be telling you what should and shouldn't be in your feelings. So it could be true that your jealousy is based in something that you need to examine and is not rational or true or is an emotion you need to take responsibility for. But if someone else is telling you, you shouldn't be jealous, that's irrational and can't hold that reaction with compassion and say, why is this happening? Do you think, is there anything I can do to help you feel safer? Then we can examine the root of this together and maybe heal it. If they can't do that and they're instead just saying your thoughts or your feelings are wrong and incorrect or untrue, that's a major red flag and something that Tashi said people should never be doing, whether it's a partner or spiritual teacher or parent or whoever else might be telling you that. Yes, emotions are your responsibility, but it's never up to someone else to dictate what should and shouldn't be in your emotions, which I thought is a very good, important distinction.
It is a really important distinction, and it is one of those things that I think is really hard to, let me say this, it's hard for me to do, right? Like, I can see someone else having a reaction to something, and I can be thinking in my mind, it's not cold, like, get over it, but it is like, you know, there's a different way you could look at this, and this is an overreaction, and I recognize that in myself. It's just sort of a generalized fear of emotion. It's a generalized, like, oh, someone else is having a strong emotion near me. That's not safe. And I know the reasons why I respond that way, and I work very hard not to do that. And yet I feel it arise in me. I feel it arise in me, and I have to work with it.
I think, again, it's like everyone's responsible for their own emotions. That doesn't mean you can't help hold other people's in compassion. That's what it is to be in relationship, yeah, often. But that also doesn't mean you should just tolerate any situation or anyone throwing any emotions on them. You know, you can have compassion with boundaries. You can say, I have compassion for, you know, the fact that you are having a lot of trouble with jealousy, but after years of trying to work with you on this, it's a boundary for me that I can't work with this anymore. And that's okay. That can be a loving thing to step away.
Yes.
Where it becomes unloving is when you stay in a dynamic where you're kind of feeding your suffering and the other person's suffering by saying, no, you should be different.
Yes.
This is wrong, or whatever else, that you can't hold what they're feeling with compassion. But yeah, it's always going to be that we're going to have responses to what other people are feeling. And sometimes we do need to have those boundaries or say, look, I can't talk to you when you're being this reactive.
Yep.
That can totally come from a loving place.
Hello, listening friends. This is Ginny, and I just wanted to pause for a moment to tell you about something. When I became a certified mindfulness teacher, I did so through the year-long training program offered through the Mindfulness Training Institute. And it was a truly transformative year of my life, and they are currently enrolling for their next training class. It's going to be in Berkeley, California in September of this year, 2022, and they're currently accepting applications. So I thought I might share just a little bit about it with you. And if you're interested, you can go to mindfulnesstraininginstitute.com and apply for this next cohort. The Mindfulness Training Institute has been training people for 10 years with over 300 graduated teachers working in 30 countries around the world. And the year-long training program is led by my two teachers, the two renowned teachers, Mark Coleman and Martin Aylward, who between the two of them have 5 decades of teaching experience. The training is really deeply experiential, really intimate. So there are 4 in-person training modules that take place, in this case, in California. And they really allow for a deep in-person connection with the teachers and with your trainee peers. I will say that I have made lifelong friends through this program. But as a result, you really learn to teach with confidence, with clarity, and it really grows your own practice in incredible ways. So if you have been thinking that mindfulness, which has touched your life, might be something you want to bring to others, again, whether it's in your local community or perhaps even in your workplace, I really encourage you to check it out. Again, I can't say enough good things about the program and about my two teachers. So again, if you're interested, you can go to mindfulnesstraininginstitute.com, and I would encourage you to go and apply now if you're interested, because they are currently enrolling for the upcoming cohort that begins in September of this year. It'll take place in Berkeley, California. Okay, friends, take care.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position.
warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer? Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
I want to move on from non-monogamy in a minute with just a couple statements that you wrote that I think are useful. And you said one of them was perhaps romantic happiness had less to do with the relationship model itself than having a foundation of secure attachment and compatible desires. I think that's a great way of summing it up. And you also say there's nothing inherently abusive or enlightened about non-monogamy. The individual's behavior determines that.
Absolutely. And same thing about monogamy, right? We see that everywhere, that monogamy can be a ripe breeding ground for abuse in terms of that's kind of 101 of why were you wearing that? Why were you talking to him, right? Mm-hmm. Over half of women who are murdered in the United States are killed by romantic partners, and 12% of those cases are associated with jealousy. So obviously you can have monogamy be a breeding ground for abuse, but also you can have great love stories, and we see the whole gamut of that depicted in media, from the terrible outcomes to the most beautiful love stories. It's just the non-monogamy so marginalized and taboo that that really has to be reminded and said explicitly of, like, look, it's not the relationship model itself, it's the people, just in the same way as monogamy. You're going to have any range of outcomes.
Yes, I think that's a great way of saying it. So let's move on to jealousy. Because when you open up the relationship on Adam's side, you are suddenly attacked by, I don't know why he's called the green, why is jealousy considered the green monster? Do you know in your research on jealousy?
You know, I should know that, and I actually don't. I don't remember.
Well, jealousy is the green monster. I don't know why. But you are attacked by it, and you describe a scene in the book where a woman walks into, maybe you guys are at a bar, I don't remember, a restaurant, a woman walks in, sits down, starts flirting with him, and the phrases that come to your mind are so vicious and so angry, like instantly. And you describe they're not even thoughts you normally would have. It's not the way you think. Tell me about that moment.
Yeah, it was incredibly humbling and informative and kind of illustrative of social conditioning, really, because before that, I had never thought of myself as a jealous person. You know, I kind of even like it when partners I have like flirt with other people at parties, but that had always been within the context of monogamy. And this happened right after we opened the relationship, like 2 days after. And so the context of knowing he could now act on it, which he did, seemed to like change my entire emotional response. So first of all, that was just interesting. But yeah, I found all these phrases that I'd only seen on, I don't know, like Ricky Lake or Maury, like as a child, started coming into my head of like all these insults and kind of images of that, like woman lunging at another woman and things that I was horrified by, because I was like, these are not thoughts I'm familiar with. I was familiar with feeling anxious or maybe self-hating, but I didn't tend to, before that experience, ever turn it on other people, especially not other women. I like to think that I was, you know, not that kind of feminist. I wouldn't do that, right? And so it's very humbling of immediately like, yes, you would, given the right trigger. And that was kind of the continual lesson of jealousy, was that it's so primal. It gets at so many of your childhood wounds. And it's also a word that actually encompasses many different emotions. It's that envy, green-eyed monster, but it's also our feelings of inadequacy, our fear of abandonment, like our feelings of enmity towards someone else, that we're going to be replaced. It's anger, it's self-hatred, it's anxiety and fear of the unknown. It's a perfect encapsulation of so many of the things that humans struggle with, a feeling, am I enough? Am I fundamentally lovable? Is there anything that can be counted on in the future or in life? Will other people leave me? It makes all of that feel for a lot of people, a lot more unstable. And that's why most people make the deal of monogamy, is because it's difficult emotional terrain for most people.
Yes, you described it. I think the chapter heading was hell, perhaps, something like that, because it is. I mean, being deep in that is so painful. And you just described all the different ways it's painful. You know, it's not just one thing. I remember my son's mother left me when he was 2 for another guy. You know, she came home one day and said, I'm not in love with you anymore, and I'm in love with this guy. And literally felt like I descended into hell.
Yeah.
And jealousy was a big part of that. There were a lot of things going on. You know, not living with my son was extraordinarily painful. But the jealousy that came up in that rendered me helpless for a while.
It's very intense. And at the same time, I think that's what you see throughout, I find so compelling about exploring it as this sort of emotional adventurer.
Mm-hmm.
I felt this strong sense because of the way Adam was framing it as the more evolved way to be, but also just a curiosity within myself of when I feel a strong emotion coming up that I don't want to identify, whether it doesn't match my values, my behavior is not matching my values or my emotional state, I get very curious to see if I can condition myself a different way. You know, like, I know neuroplasticity is real. And,
yep.
And so I was very much like, if I could just push through this feeling, I started to hope, like, because this is so challenging and so visceral and primal, and it's so clearly getting at core wounds and beliefs about myself, that I felt like if I could just come through the other side of this feeling, like, maybe I will really accept impermanence. Maybe I will really experience non-attachment. Maybe I won't even fear death, because it felt like the most effective, prolonged ego challenge mm-hmm. possible. Like, I felt more challenged than I've done plenty of psychedelics alone, even. And those have been useful experiences psychologically in terms of pushing myself to dissolve some of my attachments to myself mm-hmm. and ego. But this was a next level
yep.
experience for me. And it was so prolonged and persistent. So I felt like if I could just come through, maybe I would be really fearless, or maybe I wouldn't have this attachment to my own separate identity in the same way, because I've had to have it challenged. This is kind of the most visceral way to challenge ego, is someone you love and you're deeply attached to. And in this case, I really feared losing, which made it even harder, is out with someone else.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, that just is going to trigger everything.
Yeah, and you really went through it. You had this sort of battle of, on one hand, yes, I want to use this, use the word liberation, right, a lot. I want to use this to free me from these destructive emotions. You know, I want to use it to, as you said, loosen my grip on ego and lessen my fear of death. And so do you feel like you have found a way to work with it more skillfully? And do you feel like leaning into that was a helpful thing?
Yeah, it's a great question. I do think leaning into it was a helpful thing. But for me, I kind of had to push it so far to realize it was too much. And you kind of hit a point where it's not beneficial, it's masochism. And so I think taking it to that extreme helped me come to a place where now, more than ever, I value equanimity. It's kind of like the pendulum swung so far the other way. There was the total comfort of monogamy and
yep.
no ego challenge. And I was always the one to dump the partner, was never allowing myself to be fully vulnerable. Then swung into this relationship with Adam, where it was non-monogamous, where it was a dom sub dynamic. So I really felt like totally at someone else's mercy in so many ways, and really lost myself in that. But then when I sort of came back, it helped me find, I think, and value the middle way
mm-hmm.
more, because now I definitely am still interested in challenging myself, and I'm still interested in confronting jealousy, and I'm still non-monogamous, but I would never go back to a situation, or I hope, like I describe in the book, where I'm just anxious all the time, or I'm self-medicating with drugs or controlling behaviors. I think I value a lot more now the symptoms of my relationship, or relationships, I should say. That, like, that's one distinction I make in the book, is like, you can really love someone and they can love you. But if you were to make a list of the symptoms that love is creating, what would it look like? And so for me at the time, it would have been like anxious all the time, no longer trust my own judgment or reality. Like I need to be better, over-exercising, controlling food, self-medicating with weed. Now I'm in a situation where my partner, you know, we're still non-monogamous, but it's a much less breakneck pace of things. It's a much more value on equanimity and security and safety. And the symptoms of that, maybe it doesn't always feel in every moment as intense and exciting all the time, which I think people with anxious attachment can sometimes confuse with true love, mm-hmm. when really what they're feeling is the chase.
Yep.
And it feels much more secure. But the symptoms, I'm like, well, I wrote my first book. I sleep great. You know, my health is really good. I have a regular meditation practice. These are all things that I did, not my partner,
right.
But I can look at, you know, what is that relationship reinforcing? What are the symptoms of my lifestyle and my health under the conditions? And that was an important distinction for me to show, because I think when people are stuck in relationships that are very dramatic, or even in this case, you know, emotionally abusive, it gets very confusing. And sometimes people on the outside, it's so obvious that it's a bad situation that they can kind of be like, that's not love. And then you get further isolated because you're like, but I'm in love and he loves me.
Yep.
And so it was important for me to say to the reader, I understand, like, you can really love someone and they can really love you. But can you look at that distinction of what are the symptoms of that love if you were to list them out?
Yeah. What's sort of the fruit of the relationship? You know, what's coming out of it? You can really deeply love / care for someone and it be absolutely the wrong situation. I mean, my most recent ex, that was the case. We were a terrible fit and I was miserable through that whole relationship. But there was a great deal of care and affection, and there still is. Mm-hmm. There's one other thing that you said, you touched on it there and you said it in the book, and I love this line. You said, I wasn't sure what was the discomfort necessary for growth and what pushed me beyond healthy limits. And I think that is such a great reflection and question, because we know we need to be uncomfortable to grow, right? Whether it be physically, like if I want bigger muscles, I know the way that I'm going to get them is by discomfort. Lifting in a way that does not feel comfortable. So we know that we need to go beyond that. And yet, as you sort of described earlier, there's a way of way overshooting that mark and getting into a place where our reactions are so strong. We can't grow in that environment either. There is sort of a Goldilocks zone.
Absolutely. And just to continue that idea of the lifting weights, that if we never take rest days, we're also not going to grow our muscles. Yep. So I think I was not valuing enough the importance of rest and stillness. And there's kind of, you just see me pushing the equivalent of high intensity interval training day after day after day after day. And so in some ways, yeah, I was in great shape, but in other ways, like I was not actually growing muscle the way I could have if I rested more and I was more than that, not healthy. So I think people who are curious about growing emotionally and spiritually, which I imagine is most people who listen to your podcast.
I would imagine.
I think we can be particularly susceptible to that, where you have to be careful that it, you know, spiritual or emotional evolution doesn't fall into being one more thing that you have to check off your to-do list. Like, I love your interviews with Oliver Berkman, who wrote 4,000 Weeks, is such a great book all about this of like, we're not really valuing rest and stillness enough. And we treat even often like our leisure activities as something towards self-betterment, or as if there's going to be some place we reach where now if we
yep.
meditate enough, or we push ourselves emotionally enough, or even we're still enough, then we'll, you know, have arrived. And his whole thing is like, no, there's not going to be a point
yes.
where you arrive. It's just right now. I think it's something I know I have to continue to work with and just be careful with, of walking that line again, that middle way of, yes, some discomfort is good, but your body will really tell you if it's the right kind. And one distinction I also like in the book is the Buddhist teacher Kyra Jewel Lingo, who I don't know if you've interviewed her.
I haven't.
She's great. She just had a book come out, actually. Because another main question I had that's similar is, what is the difference between intuition and fear? Because that started getting very confused, especially in a dynamic with someone who said, that's not your intuition, that's your fear. And so I was like, okay, I could sort of see how that's true. And she said the difference you might understand between intuition and fear is that fear tends to kind of contract you and close you down, whereas intuition is a little more expansive. But again, that doesn't mean that anytime you experience fear, it's bad or incorrect.
That's right.
It's just that you can know the difference by that contraction or that expansion. And if you're in a situation where you're getting contracted and contracted by fear, but saying, no, I just need to push through this, it might be a sign that you need to like step off the gas a little bit so that you can step into more of that expansive space of intuition instead.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snag a Job is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position: warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snag a Job's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It can be difficult to get the right balance in our social life. Do we need more contact with people? Do we need more time alone? This can be really challenging to figure out. And one tool that we can use for this is therapy. It can give us the self-awareness to build the right level of social life that doesn't sort of drain our battery. Therapy has been incredibly important to me in the past. And if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's really easy. I actually signed up for it again this week because there's something I wanted to talk with a specific type of therapist about for a short time. And so I went online, I answered what I was kind of looking for, what type of therapist I was looking for, the issues. It matched me with somebody a few hours later, and that person reached out to me like 30 minutes after that and asked to schedule an appointment. So it could not have been easier. So find your sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/feed today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/feed. That question of intuition is one I find endlessly fascinating, because intuition feels very deep. It feels very available. It feels very strong. It feels very right. But so do our worst and most destructive patterns, right? I mean, doing heroin felt really right to me. It felt in my bones like it was the thing to do, right? That was not intuition, right? And so I do think this question of determining what are our habitual conditionings and what's intuition. And I'm changing direction a little bit here, but I was reading an article you wrote. It's been a while now. It's probably 6 years ago you wrote it, about being on SSRIs. And I have done the on SSRI, off SSRI dance. And in that article, you wrote something that really grabbed me. And it basically says, was I more authentically myself, off the drugs or on them? How did I know who the real me was? And what did that even mean? This idea of what's really me, what's really right, is such a perplexing idea. Because at the most deep sort of Buddhist spiritual level, we'd say, well, there is no actual essence of you there. Mm-hmm. So, okay, let's set that aside for now. Because one level up from that, there is very much a me that comes out of all the conditions that have evolved my life. My parent who raised me, my genetics, all these countless causes and conditions. There are ways to be more or less healthy within that construct of personality, if we want to call it. But knowing what's the real me, boy, is that an endless question.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that in some ways, that's what my writing will probably always be about, and just kind of tracking the impermanence of the answer and the evolution of that, I think is really interesting to me. I mean, I think I also, again, how Tashi put it to me, where he said, what matters is the intention and how it meets the result. Mm. So that can be one litmus test that can be useful. I think he's also, since he's a Buddhist monk, is very much like, you should go with whatever brings less suffering, which I do find useful as a barometer, but I have more resistance to, again, because of being that kind of emotional explorer or artist type, where it's like, I'll take the lows. I want to, you know, experience all that life has to offer. But but there is something to be said for thinking, will this decision lead to more suffering for myself and others or less? And what happens if you just keep following the one that's less? And not thinking of that as a route of passivity, but rather just a way to make decisions. Because sometimes the thing that will cause less suffering is actually going to require a lot of action.
That's right.
It might mean leaving a relationship that's really hard to leave. It might mean going vegan. It might mean doing things that are very challenging.
That's right.
It's not a passive thing to prioritize less suffering, but it can be a useful way for me to see, okay, should I push it farther or not?
Yeah.
Or who is the real me with the antidepressant, sorry, of like, is this fostering like less suffering in me? And that it continues to change over different periods. You know, for now, I take them again. I find it just makes it easier.
Yep.
The side effects are not such that it's causing much suffering. But at other points in my life, I've been like, no, I really want to break from this. I want to feel something different. There is a suffering here to being on it of dullness. And then it's okay, I can take a break. But again, with that sort of agnosticism of, all right, and then when I start to suffer unnecessarily, how great that this tool is there that could maybe help me. There is no solid, real me, but there is me in this moment. And am I making it unnecessarily difficult for myself in this moment to be present with myself and others? Well, maybe that's not noble so much as kind of silly.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I have done, as I said, the same on again, off again dance. And where that dance is, you know, the step we're on now is the on step. And maybe that's where it'll stay. I don't know. But one of the things that influenced my decision to go back on them was, what is the suffering I'm causing the people in my life? You know, because I just become an irritable. I am just not a lot of fun to be around, right? I just have this irritation that's bristling. And I'm good at holding it in. I'm not like snapping at people. But you can feel that, you know? You can feel when you're around somebody who's constantly irritated. So that question of suffering was one. And I think it's a great question. And it doesn't mean what will make me most comfortable right this minute. You really do have to have a bigger, broader, wiser view in order to discern what will cause suffering and what will not.
Yeah, it's that really broad definition.
Yep. Okay, I want to hit gaslighting before we run out of time. The word has come up a couple times in the show, but it's honestly not something that I really understand very well. I know that one of my favorite bands of all time is called the Gaslight Anthem, but I don't even think it has anything to do with the modern term of gaslighting. And I've heard it used in so many different scenarios in different situations that I don't fully understand it. So what does it mean to you?
Gaslighting, a definition, is manipulating someone by psychological means into questioning their sanity.
Oh.
And you can have that manipulation be conscious or not, which is tricky,
okay. But
it has to be that manipulation is there. And also, when I say gaslighting, I don't tend to refer to just one instance of it. We've all probably gaslit in an argument in moments or whatever else, kind of unwittingly. But when it's part of this really prolonged pattern of over and over, you're invalidating someone else's emotional experience or reality, saying things like, no, you're wrong, or that didn't happen. There's not a recognition that your own worldview is subjective as well, but rather it's only the other person who is subjective. And if they're not aligning with your perceptions, that they are incorrect and you need to correct that. So that's usually what gaslighting looks like, is sort of invalidating someone else's emotional experience, trying to get them to align with your reality or convince them of yours, and not being able to, on your side, admit to fallibility or that you're ever wrong, really, is one of the telling signs.
Got it. That's really helpful. And I think the distinction you put in there is really helpful for me too, which is that it's not always necessarily conscious. So the person who's quote unquote doing the gaslighting may not be thinking, oh, I'm trying to invalidate this person's emotional experience so I can manipulate them. They just think they're seeing the world as it is. Their view of the world is the way it is. And if your view of the world doesn't align with that, we got to get you in line because I know better.
Yes. And I think Adam, in his case, he really thought this was the best way to love me, that if I could just see things his way and act in accordance all the time and stop having a irrational emotional response or just kind of align with his worldview in all moments, that I would suffer less. And so I think he often really thought it was the best way to love me. And that was very confusing because as people, friends or therapists on the outside were saying, he's gaslighting you. Like, this is not okay. Like, you don't have your own opinions anymore. Like, you don't trust anything about your perception or your intuition. I would say, yeah, but like, he doesn't mean to be doing that. He's just kind of this very dominant, all-knowing guy who's super smart. And so that's just how he is. He's not thinking of that. So I think this misconception that someone who especially like emotionally abuses you has to be getting up in the morning and plotting, like, how am I going to destroy their life today, keeps a lot of people locked in those dynamics because they see how, well, the person doing, you know, hurt people hurt people. So they are often suffering a lot themselves. They need, you know, someone who needs to control someone else to that degree has a deep insecurity of abandonment, a deep disowning of their own fallibility or vulnerability. And this is why you see more often, anyone can gaslight, but more often in relationships comprised of a man and a woman, men are the gaslighters and women are the receiving end. And I think that's just because of socialization, right? Women have been taught to kind of adjust their feelings around what patriarchy wants and to believe more often that men are correct historically. And men have also been conditioned to think, until at least very recently, their worldview is a more rational counterpoint to women's emotional irrationality or craziness. And also that men have been socialized in this deeply destructive way to disown their own vulnerability and fragility, and are often in relationships where they don't feel like they can show that side of themselves. Well, it makes sense that they would then more often try to prove to themselves and others that they are correct, because they would need to reinforce that worldview of they know more, they've got it under control, they are not fallible and emotionally vulnerable in the same way. And so there's a lot of suffering there. And that was really important to me to depict in Adam, of like the suffering that he incurred. Yes, he was inflicting real psychological harm, but in upholding these kind of traditional values of what a man should be so flawlessly, in some ways, so dominant, so in control all the time of his emotions and his body even, and he was not happy.
Yeah.
And it was important for me to show that because I think patriarchy is very destructive to men.
Totally, totally. I think you describe it. If you're a white man, it's especially easy to internalize that your responsibility is to uphold these values for others' benefit. So these values of rationality and being in control, and, you know, you're supposed to know best. And you said this is its own, albeit roomier, cage. You know, it's still a cage. And I think that point is so important. And I think you do a great job in the book really depicting this, that Adam, in his way, thinks he is really doing the best and the right thing for you. He thinks he's caring for you, you know, even though what he's doing is clearly uncaring. To looking at it from the outside, you can see. But as you said, hurt people hurt. And I think that is one of the toughest dynamics when you're in a difficult relationship or a bad relationship, is this sense. You know, I can see it in the relationships I've been in the past, where there's this sense like, well, that's not who they really are. You know, back to this, who is somebody really question, you know, she's just that way because X, Y, and Z. I can see the hurt that happened. I can see how these patterns formed. I can see, and you get stuck in the belief. And this is a really hard one in relationships, like, but maybe they're going to change. And that maybe they're going to change is quite a way of keeping you hooked in.
Totally. And, you know, it's tricky because people can change, and yes, they do in every moment, right?
Yeah.
So it's not untrue. But I think another distinction that's been useful for me is you can see and have compassion again for someone, what's causing them to be harmful. And in fact, I think that's a very good exercise for people who cause harm in the world or anyone you view as an antagonist. See, like, what might be the suffering, the insecurity, the disowned vulnerability or fragility that's causing this behavior? You can see that and still, again, have boundaries and not place yourself in a situation that's going to be, again, causing unnecessary suffering. And I think one good thing that's helpful for me to keep in mind, or that I learned, is that you think if you would just love them enough that they'll change, or you can maybe heal that part of them and they'll stop hurting you, but you're actually just an enabler in that situation. And so you think you're helping them by having compassion, but really you're kind of reinforcing the pattern and the idea that that behavior is okay. And so sometimes the most compassionate thing is actually to really walk away or create a really solid boundary or whatever else it is, so that you don't enable them to basically create more bad karma for themselves. Because the more they're hurting you, they're also hurting themselves. So not only is it a bad situation for you, but it's actually a very bad situation for them.
Is a dynamic of gaslighting that the person who's doing the gaslighting doesn't think they need to change?
Yes.
Or are there situations where that person is like, yeah, I really am kind of screwed up. I'm doing my best, but I keep failing. That's a different animal, right? Gaslighting is, I don't really need to change. I've got the right view of the world. I'm doing things right. I didn't really do that bad thing. It's you. It's all you. Is that the dynamic?
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's the dynamic. And that's one of the most telling traits is, like, basically, can the person say, I am not always right, or say, I need to change this behavior? And it's certainly possible that people who are chronic gaslighters with therapy can work on changing themselves. But yeah, unfortunately, that personality type, that is one of the defining characteristics, is that they will often refuse to work on themselves or say things like, I tried therapy, I'm too smart for it, or something like that, you know, or it doesn't work for me. They just think they're always right. The main delusion is thinking they're above delusion.
Ah, that's a great line. And so you use the word a couple times in the book, narcissist. Also, you know, I know a little bit about borderline personality, and borderline personality is certainly, it's never my fault. Are people who are narcissists more likely to be gaslighters? Are people who have borderline personality more likely to be gaslighters? I don't even quite know if they're the same category or what to call them, but
yeah, they are more likely to exhibit gaslighting. It's one of the main characteristics. Borderline is a narcissistic personality disorder, but certainly borderline is its own disorder. I don't think Adam had borderline personality disorder. That's a kind of specific thing, but yeah, he did exhibit narcissistic traits, as all of us do at times. But again, when it's kind of this prolonged pattern of, like, my worldview is the correct one, you need to adhere to it. That's a real intense form of narcissism that we see in lots of powerful people around the world might have that view of their own opinions. You know, Putin, for example, is a current example. That's kind of an expression of, yeah, my view is correct.
Yep.
And everyone else be damned. It's definitely a form of narcissism.
You say that gaslighters follow a predictable sort of pattern. Can you share what that pattern looks like in a romantic relationship?
Yeah. One of the main characteristics in the beginning is something that psychologists call love bombing. So often when we fall in love with someone who chronically gaslights, or people who are extremely narcissistic, they tend to be very charming and charismatic and very romantic. There's a lot of talk of, like, rescuing you and delivering you to a better life, and you can feel like you stepped into a fairy tale. And again, this might not all be like a conscious manipulation on their part, but mm-hmm. this is part of how the person on the receiving end gets really hooked, because they reach this level of feeling desired and seen and cherished on a level they've never felt before. And so as that is slowly begins to be withdrawn incrementally, the person being gaslit tries to get back to that place, basically. And there's a kind of narrative established of, if I could just be good enough, or if I could just, you know, adapt to his way of being non-monogamous, then he'll love me again that way. So yeah, after the love bombing stage, or as that's happening, often they will start criticizing you a lot, correcting a lot of things you do. And you might resist that at first, or have a fight, or even try to leave. And they'll often become sort of even like hysterical, because their fear of abandonment is triggered. And you get into this kind of fight and makeup cycle, like with Adam, that when I tried to, in the beginning, like assert certain boundaries, that he would literally block the door and say, like, you can't get space. Like, we need to reconcile this now. We can't stay angry. And he would make me let him touch my leg or something like that. So there was this kind of thing of like, I was not allowed to even get space to be upset with him. And he would kind of become desperate to have me not leave. And he would say, I'll do whatever you want, okay? And he would become suddenly very vulnerable. And so this kind of indomitable figure would lower himself and beg and plead. And then you'd reconcile and the cycle would start again. So something would happen where, you know, I'd be criticized too much, or he would push too far, or I would try to stand up for, I know this is not okay, how you're talking to me or what you're doing. And he would get very defensive and say, no, you're wrong. And if I got the strength to try to leave, which I did many times, then he would prevent me from doing that by begging or making promises. Another trait is that if they get caught in a lie, they will never usually admit to a lie. So you see examples of that throughout the book. Under those conditions, you become increasingly anxious, you know, because obviously you now no longer trust your own sense of reality of someone telling you all the time that you're incorrect or that you need to change. Phrases like, oh, what would you do without me to take care of you, are very common. So you sort of lose trust in your own self-sufficiency. And so because you're so anxious in this dynamic, that kind of feeds their argument that you're acting irrationally, that no one else will love you, you just need to change. And the cycle continues, and you become increasingly, as I do in the book, self-isolating, anxious, self-medicating. You don't tell your friends or family about the problems, because often the gaslighter will say things like Adam did of like, don't say bad things about the relationship and incriminate people against our relationship. They're going to never like me if you say anything. So these are all patterns of not just gaslighting, but emotional abuse as well. That's part of how it works. And it's very confusing. It's very destructive. And part of what I wanted to show is how it can really happen to anyone. I'd seen my friends be in situations like that, where I was like, it was so obvious. Or maybe I thought, oh, I would never do that. I feel bad for them, but I wouldn't fall into that. I'm too self-assured. And part of what was really important to me, because I had this really unusual recording of how this unfolded over many years, because Adam allowed me to record so many of our conversations, therapy sessions, I was able to really depict almost verbatim in the book, with psychologists commenting throughout, how exactly this dance works and how it happens incrementally over time to even the most self-assured, intelligent people. That really doesn't have anything to do with it.
Dr. Robin Stern says that high-achieving, ambitious women are particularly prone to being in relationships with men who gaslight them. Why do you think that is?
Yeah, they're determined to impress the one person they can't ever seem to fully convince of their aptitude.
Got it.
And also, I think that these people tend to be very, very dominant personalities. And so people who are very on top of it in their professional lives tend to sometimes enjoy being submissive in their relationships or in the bedroom, because it's a relief from that burden of feeling like you're always in control or have to be on top of it. So at first, it can be a relief when you're someone who's very in your head to have someone else saying, don't worry, I've got it all under control. I know it's right. I've configured it out for you. The problem is that comes at a high price.
Yeah, I had a moment a couple weekends ago where I was in that spot. I was like, I just wish anybody, like someone tell me what's the right thing. And of course, knowing that that's impossible, that like, A, the answer is unknowable and nobody can know for me what the right thing for me is except me. But boy, is that desire sometimes there. Well, I think the good news is that you emerged on the other side of this with a lot of healing and a lot of help. And you and I are going to talk in the post-show conversation a little bit more about some of that. We're going to talk about 25 practical tips from a Buddhist monk you recently got to, you know, help us deal with the despair of the world. We might talk a little bit more about the signs of gaslighting. But there was a line that you used that I loved, and I thought maybe I could read it, and then you could say a little bit about it, and we could kind of end on it. And you said, basically, you had this growing realization that the only person who could really promise to always take care of me was me, and sort of a growth into really loving and trusting yourself in that way.
Yeah, that was such an important lesson, and it's almost a cliche, you know, woman emerges from bad relationship only to love herself. But I think like there's a reason for that cliche, is that it's a lesson a lot of people need to learn. And especially when you're socialized as a woman, you're taught to believe that your life in many ways is something, at least on the romantic front, that's going to happen to you. Like you're going to come and be rescued. We're not taught to like necessarily go and find the Prince Charming, right? Or ask out the person we have a crush on. There's this kind of passivity or resigning to fate, which might not always be conscious. We often don't believe in that, but it is the way we've been taught to see our lives. Whereas I say, like, men much more often are taught to view themselves in narratives, childhood narratives, as sort of the action hero, the protagonist, the initiator. And that's a very different way to be socialized to go through life, right? One you're much more in control of and have agency, and the other one is passive. So I think that learning to love and see myself as my own soulmate was a way of reclaiming, yes, there's hardly anything you can control in life, but I can at least promise to always be there for myself through all of it. That's an incredibly powerful realization to lean into, and also that self-nurturing is incredibly powerful, and that the only reason we think of it as soft or kind of like hippy-dippy is because of the feminine energies being devalued.
Yes.
But there's incredible strength in that. And so Tara Brach, who I know you've had on the podcast and who I love, she was a huge part of my healing. And that practice of rain, learning to sit with emotions, recognize them, investigate them in the body, but then really that last step of nurture, to say to myself the things I had been depending on Adam or someone else to say, this imaginary ideal other of, I'll always be there for you, Rachel. You know, I think you're doing so great. I love you. If we can learn to literally say those things to ourselves, even in moments of extreme instability or grief, I think it can be really transformative and powerful, or at least it was for me.
Awesome. Well, I think that's a great place to wrap up. As I mentioned, you and I will continue in the post-show conversation. Listeners, if you'd like to get access to post-show conversations, ad-free episodes, a special episode I do each week called Teaching Song and a Poem, and other great benefits of being a member, go to oneyoufeed.net/join. Rachel, thank you so much for coming on. I really enjoyed the book, and I've really enjoyed talking with you.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
If what you just heard was helpful to you, please consider making a monthly donation to support the One You Feed podcast. When you join our membership community with this monthly pledge, you get lots of exclusive members-only benefits. It's our way of saying thank you for your support. Now, we are so grateful for the members of our community. We wouldn't be able to do what we do without their support, and we don't take a single dollar for granted. To learn more, Make a donation at any level and become a member of the One You Feed community. Go to oneyoufeed.net/join. The One You Feed podcast would like to sincerely thank our sponsors for supporting the show.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. It's a simple truth. No matter who you are, mental health challenges can affect you, and how you manage them can make all the difference. That's why everyone should have access to mental health support that meets them where they are and helps them get through. BetterHelp provides online therapy on your schedule. It's flexible, simple to use, and more affordable than in-person therapy. Connect with a licensed therapist selected just for you. Learn more at BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp.com.